From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, new research on ESP with Paul Smith. But here's what's happening. Well, now marking five disastrous weeks, BP readied yet another attempt to slow the oil gushing into the Gulf as a federal report has alleged that drilling regulators have been so close to oil and gas companies that they've been accepting gifts and even negotiating to go to work for them. President Barack Obama prepared to head to the Gulf on Friday to review efforts to halt the millions of gallons of contaminating crude, while scientists said underwater video of the leak showed the plume growing significantly darker, suggesting heavier, more polluting oil is spewing out. BP's next effort to stop the damaged oil well, perhaps on Wednesday, will be forced feed heavy drilling mud and cement into the well to plug it. The tactic is called a top kill, has never been tried a mile beneath the sea, and company executives estimate its chances of success at 60 to 70%. Monitoring the situation for us is Captain Kelly Sweeney. Kelly, I'm getting more and more concerned that we're not getting the information we need to get. There's just too much going on here, too many strange things. Don't you agree?
I agree, George. And it's funny that all of a sudden the ROV cameras on the remotely operated vehicle showed the increase in the amount of spill. But it's interesting. You and I have been talking about this right from the beginning. But today the administration finally admitted that this is going to go down in U.S. history as the biggest oil spill ever. They admitted that, and it's going to happen. The top kill, like you said, 60 to 70% chance of success, and that's BP. I mean,
cut that by another 30%
exactly.
In terms of their estimate.
And if that doesn't work, the next viable alternative that is guaranteed to work, as we've discussed, are the relief wells, and they aren't going to be ready for 2 months. And you know, another thing, George, and I know that you care about the people out there just like I do, my fellow mariners, and we've talked a little bit about this, but crude oil has inherently, this crude oil has gases that can kill within a matter of minutes. And the dispersants that they're using, and we've discussed this at various times, are toxic themselves. Now, there are reports coming out of the coastal areas and on the water of oil spill cleanup workers becoming ill.
Yes.
And experts are saying the symptoms are classic overexposure to crude oil and to dispersants, just as they saw it back in the Exxon Valdez 21 years ago.
Frightening. All right, Kelly, continue to monitor this situation for us. Thank you so much. The stress caused by the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center may have led to an increase in miscarriages of male fetuses, according to U.S. researchers. Very strange story. A study found that 12% more male babies were lost in September of 2001 after the 20th week of pregnancy than in a normal September. Data says fewer boys were born in all states 3 to 4 months after 9/11. The review by the University of California is said to support the theory of communal bereavement. Now, this is defined as acute mental distress related to a major national event like 9/11, even if there were no direct connection to those who died or were involved in these events. Wow, how about that one? President Barack Obama will send 1,200 National Guard troops to boost security along the U.S.-Mexico border. The president will also request $500 million for border protection and law enforcement activities. North Korea, here we go, said it is cutting all ties with the South and threatened its neighbor with military action over alleged violations of its waters off the West Coast. The comments marked a new high in tensions on the divided peninsula after the March sinking of a South Korean warship, which Seoul blames on a torpedo fired by the communist North. The increasingly warlike rhetoric hit Seoul's financial markets, prompting policymakers to call an emergency meeting to look for ways to calm investors out there. The Food and Drug Administration is looking into reports of at least 775 serious side effects from drugs recalled by McNeil, a division of Johnson & Johnson, according to a source close to a congressional investigation. Included in the reports were 30 deaths. Nearly all were found to be not to be tied to McNeil's recall of Tylenol, Motrin, and Benadryl from January 1st through April 30th, according to another source close to the investigation. The FDA is also investigating reports of several hundred serious side effects. The government says unintended acceleration in Toyota vehicles may have been involved in the deaths of 89 people over the past decade. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said that from 2000 to mid-May, it had received more than 6,200 complaints involving sudden acceleration in Toyota vehicles. Stock market had another seesaw day. Stocks fell sharply in early trading, then recovered late in the day. People are just skittish. Registered investment advisor Mish Shedlock with us. Mish, there's been some talk that it's going to get down to 8,000. It's hovering around 10 right now. What do you think?
I think that's a good bet. I think the S&P's probably got a date back with the, 850, perhaps all the way back to that 666 low. We had that scare out of North Korea that's just really a symptom. All of these things are a symptom of this bad environment that we're in. And it affects things on the periphery first. Notice how it went from Greece to Portugal to Spain. Here, we had a warning on this, actually. Anyone who's watching the Shanghai stock market, it peaked in November of last year, and it started declining way before the U.S. stock market did. Yep. Now we're seeing Asia, then Europe, now the U.S. I think we're in for a repeat disaster. If I can get one more comment in, I'd like to get it in.
Sure.
I really appreciate all these news reports you do, about the oil. It's places like Coast to Coast where we're getting the real information about what's going on out there. Mainstream media is not reporting on this. People are definitely getting sick. There's YouTubes out this. And it's not just it's the fumes, but when they're doing medical research on these people, they look as if they've been smoking cigarettes for all their life when they were just out there trying to do their best to help clean up the spill.
All right, Mish, thank you for your input into the show, by the way. U.S. researchers claim to have identified a new potential cause for colony collapse disorder in honeybees. The disease is responsible for wiping out many beekeepers' entire colonies over the past few years, as we've been reporting. Scientists from the U.S. Department of Agriculture say the pathogens to blame are a fungus and a family of viruses out there. Our feature story at coasttocoastam.com. Go take a look at that picture. A fisherman in China was surprised to catch a mystery creature which looked like a cross between a dinosaur and a turtle. The catch was later identified as an alligator snapping turtle, which is not native to the country. The species is only native to North America and was probably someone's pet before being dumped in the lake. How did it get out there? Up next, we're going to talk about more guns, less crime, and how does it affect you with Dr. John Lott next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. John Lott is a senior research scientist at the University of Maryland and was the chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission during the 1988-1989 period. John received his PhD in economics from UCLA in 1984. He has published more than 100 articles in academic journals, also several books, The Bias Against Guns, More Guns, Less Crime, which is now out in its third edition, and Freedomomics. And John, here we are. Welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Great to talk to you again. Thanks for having me on.
All right. You too, John. Hey, tell me now, this is the third edition. We're still fighting for guns, but there seems like they're trying to whittle away, huh?
Yeah, well, it's a never-ending battle. I mean, you look at somebody like Elena Kagan being appointed to the Supreme Court, or you look at the Obama administration just announcing the other day that they wanted to support the UN Small Arms Treaty, and there's lots of dangers out there. I mean, we won the Heller decision 2 years ago where the Supreme Court struck down the D.C. gun ban, but it was pretty close. It was a 5-4 decision. We may win the McDonald case, the Chicago gun ban, by a similar 5-4 decision, and lose one of the moderate to conservative justices there, and the decisions would start going the other way.
Chicago Mayor's Daily last week. What did he do with a reporter there? Because
it was pretty weird.
It was weird.
He was asked whether he would admit that the gun control rules weren't exactly working the way he had promised that they would work in Chicago, that Chicago has actually had a significant increase in murder rates so far this year over last year. And he keeps on saying, well, more gun control the answer, and they're already banning handguns and making it difficult for people to use other guns in self-defense there. And rather than kind of answer directly the reporter's question, he grabbed a gun that was apparently up there on the stage and started saying, what happens if I were to shove this gun up your butt and fire it? Would you feel safer then? You know, so pretty weird statements there. So apparently most of the press was just sat there stunned for several minutes while he went ranting on. And finally, I guess for comic relief, they laughed a little bit. But he's in a difficult position in terms of actually explaining why he supports the gun ban. One of the things I show in this third edition of More Guns, Less Crime is that every place in the world that we have crime data for, where a gun ban's been put in place, we see an increase in murder rates. In fact, if I would recommend, if people are ever debating others about the gun control issue, probably the number one answer you should ask them is, okay, you think gun control works? Tell me one place in the world, whether it's at a city or a state or national level, where we've had a gun ban and there's been a reduction in murder, even one place where murder rates have stayed the same. And they're not going to be able to give that to you. Now, maybe they can come up with an excuse in one area or the other, but for it to fail every single time and not just have murder rates go up by a little bit, but very frequently go up by large amounts, you would think at some point, whether it's Mayor Daley seeing the increase in murders in Chicago or D.C. or other places, they would step back and say, you know, maybe this isn't working the way we want it to work.
You know, and with full disclosure, John, I am a concealed weapons permit holder, and it all started for me when your book, this first edition, came out, More Guns, Less Crime, back around 1998. Oh. And, you know, I made the decision that this is something I wanted to do. You know, because of my military background, I didn't have to go through the specific training that most people have to in order to get qualified and, you know, and then fulfilled all the other requirements. I got to tell you, in certain areas where I'm allowed to do this, I feel much safer, much safer. And I'm sure a lot of people do.
But, you know, the thing is, having somebody like you that has the training, has the experience, we probably should pay you to go and do this. And yet you're willing to go and carry around a gun for free. I never really understood why many politicians have opposed even off-duty police going and carrying guns. You know, here we trust people on the job, and yet for 13 years, legislation was delayed by a filibuster led by Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts, whether or not police, off-duty police, or police that had retired after 10 years of service, when they traveled, would be able to carry a permanent concealed handgun with them. And it only passed a couple years after 9/11, but you know, there you had a situation also where, you know, it's amazing. These guys are willing to help protect us for free, even when they're not working on the job. And, you know, we have so many vulnerable targets, and yet these guys, in part because they felt safer themselves, would be willing to produce this benefit for us. You know, if they're traveling and visiting a monument or someplace else and they see a crime, they, with their experience, would be able to help stop it. And yet there was fear even of police carrying guns.
What is happening in countries where they have confiscated guns or they don't allow their citizens to carry guns or own guns? What's going on there, John?
Well, it's the same thing that's happened in D.C. or Chicago. Every time we've seen these types of bans, murder rates have gone up. But, you know, often the excuse that's given in places like D.C. or Chicago is, well, it's not really a fair test. Because even though we have the right rules in these cities, which ban guns, people can go and get them from other places and bring them in. And so if we only could extend this ban to the whole country, then we would get our utopia that we'd like to have. And yet we can look around the world, look at island nations that don't have to blame it on some neighbor that's there, that have relatively well defensible borders, and yet you see the same increases, whether it's Ireland or the UK or Jamaica. I mean, here we just have today this huge gunfight between gangs in Kingston, Jamaica. The military and the police there. What the news people never say, they're having these huge gunfights, even though the guns they're using are all illegal. And yet they had something like 30 people killed today, at least, in a nation of less than 3 million people. It's a fairly substantial number. And yet it's not an unusual day, really, in Jamaica, because Jamaica has a murder rate of about 60 per 100,000 people. Our murder rate right now is about 5 per 100,000. And, we all want to try to take guns away from criminals. The problem you have to ask, and this is true for gun control generally, is who's most likely to obey the laws. And if it turns out that it's the law-abiding good citizens who obey the laws and not the criminals, and you disarm them relative to the criminals, that rather than making the victim safer, you actually make it safer for the criminals to go and commit their crimes.
How does a criminal get an illegal gun? What's the process here? How does this happen?
Well, take some place like an island nation, even, where they ban guns. They get it through drugs. Just as you can go and bring illegal drugs into the country, the gangs that go and sell these drugs have an incentive to go and bring in weapons in order to protect their valuable drugs. Similar types of things even happen in the United States. There was a report that came out at the beginning of last year from the Justice Department that indicated that about 80% of crime in the United States was gang-related, and the vast majority of that was drug gang-related. And so we know how difficult it is to go and stop drugs from coming into the country. The government spent huge amounts of money on that. Why do they think it's going to be any easier to ultimately stop these gangs from getting guns in order to protect these very valuable drugs that they're selling? It's not like if another gang comes onto your turf, it's not like you go and call up the police to say, can you get them to move? These gangs, these drug gangs, set up their own militaries to essentially do that. And gangs can, and criminals can obviously get guns in many different ways. They can steal them. They can smuggle them in. There's, almost an untold number of ways they can go and get their guns.
And to say nothing of what happens with tyranny in countries where the citizens do not have the right to own guns.
Well, that's right. We mentioned earlier the UN Small Arms Treaty. One of the big supporters of that are actually totalitarian governments. What they want to go and call terrorists there are people that you and I might call freedom fighters in many of these cases. And they want to control people who oppose their government, who want to try to stop some of the worst dictatorships from being able to try to oppose them. The other bad thing about the UN Small Arms Treaty is that in order to help enforce that, John Bolton, who was the UN ambassador under the Bush administration, has pointed out recently that that it's going to open the ways for pushes for registration and licensing in the United States to supposedly control the flow of guns outside the country. But, that not only won't it help crime in the United States, but I don't think it's going to be any more successful in stopping guns going to groups around the world than Jamaica is able to stop its gangs from being able to get guns.
John, do you think our government truly wants to confiscate or do away with guns here in possession of?
Well, it's kind of hard to go and say the government as a whole. All I can say is, and we've talked about this before, I knew Barack Obama when we were at Chicago together, and I believe strongly that he's someone who believes that Americans shouldn't own guns. And and you see this in terms of people he's appointing to the Supreme Court, both Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor have written very strongly about that in the past.
That's a good point.
And you're really just one Supreme Court justice away from overturning a lot of the gains that we've had recently.
John, we're going to take phone calls with you when we come right back. Lots of folks are interested in this. John Lott, our special guest. More guns, less crime. Well, next hour, Paul Smith drops in, and we're going to be talking about new research with ESP. He's a remote viewer. Looking forward to that. And when we come back, we'll take your phone calls with John Lott. More guns, less crime next on Coast to Coast AM. John, what necessitated the third edition of More Guns, Less Crime?
Well, it has about 200 pages of new material. It's been 10 years since the second edition came out, and there's been a lot of changes in the gun debate, so a lot more data to look at. We've had, for example, the assault weapons ban, federal assault weapons ban, sunset in 2004. One to look at to see what happened with crime rates after it sunset. You've had many more states adopt right to carry laws. We've had states adopt so-called stand your ground rules, which make it so that people no longer have to retreat as far as possible before they use a gun defensively. There's been a lot of debates over gun-free zones, not only with regard to concealed handguns and where you can take them, but also whole cities, Washington, D.C., and Chicago. So I wanted to try to look more generally, not just what happened to crime rates there, but what happened to crime rates around the world when you had gun bans go into effect.
What's going on with the gun sales and shows like that?
Well, gun sales have gone up a lot. I think Obama unintentionally has been responsible for a lot of that. But and you can see it also with concealed handgun permits. At the end of 2007, we had about 5 million people with concealed handgun permits. Right now, I'd say we have something around 6.2 million people with concealed handgun permits. And I think most of that increase occurred starting around the 2008 election and afterwards. And you've seen similar changes with regard to gun sales generally. So, and it's interesting to point out the big drop in violent crime that we had last year after all these sales have been taking place.
What about ammo? There was a time, you know, we had this run on ammo and it was very difficult to get. Is it now more available?
I think it's somewhat more available. I think it's still relatively expensive, but, you know, just as there was a big increase in demand for guns, there's the big increase for similar reasons for people to get ammunition to go in store. I think a lot of that's kind of run its path, so to speak, and we're getting down to kind of a more normal long-run rate of people buying ammunition because they already have fairly good stores of it, but it's still not back to what it was before there was the rush.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to Greenwood, Louisiana, east of the Rockies. David, you're on with John Lott on Coast to Coast. Hi, David.
Hi, I was listening to Happiness is a Warm Gun. I was in Vietnam when that one came out, the whiteout. Remember, guy had a reel-to-reel in his hole. I remember he got hit one night in a mortar attack. But anyway, fortunately, he wasn't in the hole at the time. But anyway, the people that want to take the guns away and everything, all they are, they're either the old beatniks and hippies or the offsprings of the same. I can still remember they would have peace sign in one hand, say, peace, brother, before they threw a Molotov cocktail. And anyway, what they want is to be able to do whatever they want to you and you not be able to do anything about it. And I think too many times, I don't know, when I was a kid, I used to watch these old wrestling matches, and the good guy, when he was beating up on the bad guy would, you know, plead for mercy, and the good guy would look around, and then the bad guy would hit him in the belly and then jump on him. And
the ref, of course, was talking to the crowd and didn't see anything, right?
Right. Well, it's the same way with these, you know, it's the same sort of mindset, you know. I lost my train of thought, a little nervous and all that. But they, like I said, all you have up there now is, like I said, the old beatniks and hippies. Right now, to me, this is the high water mark of the Woodstock Nation. And it's our lowest point as far as ordinary folks like myself go. So I'm just a simple old country boy. So what's
well, I guess the bottom line is, and I think what you're saying is, don't put your guard down. And, you know, that's what you could do if you aren't armed. I mean, a criminal knows that if you don't have a gun, you're an easy mark. And John Lott, you see that in statistics, don't you?
Oh, that's exactly right. That criminals, just I think most people understand that if you make it more difficult for them to commit crimes, they do less of it. We do it in many different ways: higher arrest rates, higher conviction rates, longer prison sentences, the death penalty. I think most people understand how those things discourage and keep many criminals from committing crimes. Well, the same thing's true with victims. If a victim poses more of a risk for a criminal because they're able to defend themselves, that makes it riskier and more costly for the criminal to commit those crimes also and deters them for similar reasons. I mean, it would be great if, in some sense, if the police were there or able to arrive quickly. But I think when you look at polls, most police overwhelmingly think that individuals should be able to own guns, at least the street officers. And the reason why I think they understand that is that even though they realize their important role, they also realize how they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's occurred. And that raises a real question. What should somebody do when they're having to confront a criminal by themselves? And simply telling them to behave passively turns out to be fairly bad advice. And the police know this firsthand because they understand the benefits themselves from having a gun in order to protect themselves from the criminals. And I think for at least street officers that have to go and deal with this on a real-life basis all the time, you see very strong support among them for individuals being able to own guns.
John, can you cite a story where someone, a citizen primarily, had a concealed weapon and was able to break up a crime or save someone?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's whole websites that collect these types of things. There's keepandbeararms.com. If you scroll down to the bottom of their website there, they have literally you'll find like 80, 90, 100 cases a month where just people have collected stories from different newspapers around the country. The NRA with their Armed Citizens column has some. I tried to collect some of those on my website too. There's a guy named Clayton Kramer in Idaho who has done an excellent job of collecting these from around the country. You know, you go through all those different stories and those different websites, you can easily find several hundred. My book, I just took a week and just basically went through and got 20 cases or so where individuals use permanent concealed handguns in order to stop crimes. You know, many of these may be simple robberies that are stopped, but others are multiple victim public shootings. We don't hear about them because they stop them before anything bad happens.
That's right.
And but yet, you know, so one can understand why the news media covers certain things if, you know, a bad thing happens. But even if it's not, quote, newsworthy, we still need to care about these from a policy perspective.
Let's go to British Columbia on the international line in Canada. Lori Ann is with us. Hey, Lori Ann, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. The states, if they want to make all the firearms illegal, could it be, I mean, partly it's because, I mean, all the senseless violence and everything like that, but also could it be
total
control through the government?
Right. Well, you know, I think I should first of all focus on your first part about the motivation. Surely people hear about lots of crimes that happen with guns, you know, probably without even trying. You can think to recall what seems like hundreds or thousands of bad things that have happened with guns. But, you know, the federal government does is it uses surveys to get an idea of how many crimes actually occur. Because we know for a lot of crimes, people don't report them to the police. For rapes, for example, only about half of rapes get reported to police. So the way they try to figure out how many rapes occur is to do what's called the National Crime Victimization Survey that surveys about 100,000 to 150,000 people each year. And it turns out, if you look at gun crimes, that there's about 400,000 to 450,000 gun crimes that they estimate occur every year. But on the other hand, those similar types of surveys indicate that people use guns defensively about 2 million times a year. So that's about 4 to 5 times more frequently each year people use guns to stop crimes than they use to commit them. Now, you talk about the mayhem and violence. I mean, surely that's important, but the real question we have to ask is, what's the net effect? On net, do the presence of guns save lives or cost lives? It wouldn't make any more sense just to go and point to bad things that happen with cars or bathtubs or anything else, and not also try to take into account the benefits that are there. And now, I think most people, I mean, we hear the bad things on the news. When was the last time you heard about any of these cases on the national news? My guess is, despite the huge
slim to none.
Right. And, you know, we can talk to some extent why that's the case. But whatever the reason, it has a big impact on people's perceptions about the costs and benefits of guns, and is used a lot to justify the different types of regulations and controls that you're talking about. Now, on the second point that you raised about controlling, I mean, I'm sure in when you're talking about real totalitarianism, governments want to take guns away, because the ultimate, as the founding fathers knew, I mean, they had just gone through a revolutionary war where one of the first shots were fired in Lexington and Concord, and British troops in that case had come to take away the civilian stores of guns and ammunition that were there.
Yes.
And so they had lived through firsthand where a government had tried to disarm its citizens in order to make it easier for them to control them. So that's the reason why the initial preface on the Second Amendment there about armed militia being necessary to the preservation of free state was included there. It was kind of a little history lesson. You know, our Constitution was the first written constitution, and they knew a lot of people were going to read it, so in some places they would put in little discussions there in order to help people understand in future generations why they had put in certain rules. And that was the reason why they put that in there before they go on to say the right of the people, meaning an individual right to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed.
Let's go to William in Jackson, Mississippi, on the first-time caller line. William, you're on.
How you doing, George?
Good.
I had a question for John. It's pertaining to the Second Amendment. I'm a member of a gun association, and they send out newsletters. And when one of our newsletters, they spoke about a portion in the Second Amendment stating that our military has an obligation to overthrow our government when it becomes too far out of control and give it back to the United States citizens.
Well, the Second Amendment doesn't say anything about a military controlling the government. It just makes a general statement about having militias,
an armed militia.
Right, dealt with kind of the general citizenry to serve as an ultimate bulwark in defense in case a foreign power were to try to take you over, or some might even argue
an internal power.
Right. Your own government get out of control. They didn't have anything as specific as what you're saying in there, but those types of thoughts with regard to the general citizenry serving as a constraint were surely in the back of their minds, as we were just talking about. They've just seen it firsthand with Lexington and Concord, and they're fighting the British.
What do you think would happen, and how do you think the military would react, John, if a law were passed that said that all guns were illegal, outside of those with the military, and we're going to confiscate them all, and then they assign the military to go house to house to get them, because they, first of all, know who owns them because of the permit holders and everything else. What do you think the military would do? I don't think they would go and confiscate the weapons. That's my guess.
Interesting you say that. We had one case where essentially the National Guard was ordered to go home to home in order to get people's weapons, and that was after Katrina. And there were a number of National Guard units there that just refused to enforce the order. And other ones did, though. And in fact, I was just listening the other night to a tape of some members of one National Guard unit where the entire unit just decided among themselves that they would not do it for, I'm sure, the same types of concerns and beliefs that you have. And they were saying how it was difficult to go and try to convince the local citizens to work with them for a while because they had heard of other National Guard units confiscating their weapons. And with the terror that they lived at, they didn't want to. I mean, that was their only defense against armed gangs. I mean, they were being successful getting the guns away from the good citizens there, not the gangs, who also may be physically stronger than a lot of the people there. And so they would hide away from the National Guards, and it took them a little while until this particular National Guard unit was able to convince the people that it was taking care of in its jurisdiction that they could work with them. And then those people would come with them to information about the gangs that were causing the problems, because they couldn't have done their jobs if the local citizens there didn't trust them to go and give them information. Those local citizens often served as the National Guard's eyes and ears for where the real problems were occurring. And the ones that were confiscating the weapons had a real problem earning the trust of the local citizens.
Jackie's in Weezer, Idaho. Jackie, you're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Jackie.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good.
Doing great.
The question that I have is education on our young. I'm 55, and my father set all of us six kids down knowing that ammunition, rifles, we all used it for hunting. So he required us to be able to break down the weapons, to clean them,
mm-hmm.
and also reload the weapons. When we got to the hunt, it was also known we brought it back to the dinner table. So it was a complete process that our children got to learn, and it seems to have gone by the wayside. They don't seem to know the knowledge that it's a tool instead of just a weapon.
And that lack of knowledge, I think, generates fear. You know, when I go and talk to people in New York City, for example, I'll go and tell them, and they're stunned by this, that until 1969, all but one of the public high schools in New York City had a riflery team. You literally had thousands on any given day of high school students carrying their rifles with them on subways, on buses, walking down city streets in New York City, in the way into school, storing them in the back of homerooms, taking them out again to go to the shooting ranges, and then in the evening, taking them back to their homes. You know, the notion of having thousands of kids walking around New York City with their rifles on their backs would just blow people's minds today.
Yeah.
No, and some of the people, Scalia on the Supreme Court had that experience. He was on a riflery team when he was a youngster in New York City. Colin Powell, for example, was on a riflery team when he was a youngster in New York City. And, you know, but now my guess is most kids in New York City have never even touched a gun. And that generates fear, I think, of the unknown.
Well, John Lott, we are going to find out what happens both in the courts and in legislation, and we'll keep monitoring you. More guns, less crime. John R. Lott, Jr. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Paul Smith as we talk about some breakthroughs with ESP on Coast to Coast AM.